This is the Craig Groeschel Leadership Podcast.
Hey, James, it's an incredible honor to have you on the Craig Groeschel Leadership Podcast. From day one, when I read your book for the first time, Atomic Habits, I thought I got to get this guy on. I've got to share this message with all of our audience. So thanks for taking time to spend a little bit of time interviewing with us.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
First of all, congratulations. New York Times bestseller, well-deserved, your first book out, and you hit the Times. And so no pressure if you do a second book, but the first one is truly amazing. In fact, I taught on habits to our church and promoted the book every single week. It not only impacted me, and I've read a lot about habits. It's hard to write something new and fresh, and congratulations, you did it. And so I'm thrilled to share you with our leadership audience. Let's dive in, James. I want to ask you some questions from your book and even beyond that. One of the things in my studies that I came across, and I'm sure you're aware, but about 40 to maybe even 50% of the actions that we do every day, they're not a result of conscious decisions, but they're a result of habits. And you talk a lot about how small habits make a big difference. I think people sometimes might push back and say, no, you got to do really big things. Can you unpack the reason why you believe small habits are so important for us?
Yeah, sure. So there's a couple different things to think about here. One is more strategic and one is maybe a little more tactical. So I'll cover both. So the strategic reason or the philosophical reason why small habits make a big difference is that they compound over time. They kind of add up and multiply. And this is easy to dismiss because it doesn't really feel like that on any given day, right? Like the difference between, you know, getting 1% better or 1% worse or making a slightly positive habit or falling into a slightly negative one, it doesn't really feel like a whole lot on any given day. You know, like what is the difference between, I don't know, eating a burger and fries for lunch or eating a salad? On any given day, it's not really a whole lot. You know, your body looks basically the same in the mirror at the end of the night. Scale hasn't really changed that much. Like it's easy to dismiss one way or another. But you turn around 5 years or 10 years down the line and you realize, wow, those daily choices really do add up. You know, all of a sudden you're 30 pounds heavier than you thought you would be or so on. And that's true, not just for, you know, diets and weight, but for all kinds of things. You know, like reading one book doesn't make you a genius, but if you commit to a habit of lifelong learning, well, you know, reading each day can be transformative. And so your habits kind of multiply and surprise us in that way. They set us on a very, different trajectory depending on what those daily habits are, even though they don't feel like much on any given day. So that's kind of the philosophical answer, the strategic answer. If you get 1% better each day, you end up in a very surprising place 2 or 5 or 10 years later. But then there's also a more tactical piece to it, which you mentioned, you know, just a moment ago. 40 to 50% of your behaviors on a given day are habitual. So things like tying your shoes or unplugging the toaster after each use or brushing your teeth. And the technical definition for a habit is a behavior that has been repeated more or less enough times to be automatic. So, you know, something that you can do pretty much without thinking, like brushing your teeth. And that's actually what a habit is. That's those 40 to 50% of your daily behaviors, you know, all those things that you are doing on autopilot, like covering your mouth every time you laugh or apologizing each time before you ask a question. Oh, I'm sorry, but, you know, whatever. And we don't think about those things, whether they're habits of thought or habits of action. But they often, even despite how small they are, they often set or determine how we spend the next chunk of time. So take, for example, the habit of pulling your phone out of your pocket. It's a really small habit. You do it, you know, pretty much automatically and only takes a second or two. But once you've done that habit, well, you might think consciously, you might make a careful decision about what to do next. Do I play a video game or do I open my email? Do I respond to this email from my boss or do I check social media or read an article on the web? And you can do all of those things from your phone, but whether you do those things or not was pretty much determined by, did you take your phone out of your pocket? And so habits sort of, they're kind of like the entry point for the next chunk of behavior. And so for that reason, they also have like this outsized impact. You know, they might only be 40 to 50% of your behavior by themselves, but if you add up the things that you do because of where your habits led you, well, then maybe it's 70 or 80 or even 90% of your behavior that's influenced or impacted by your habits each day.
I think one of the books that you quoted too, I think Duhigg's book on the power of habits, he talked about the keystone habits, those small disciplines that do trigger either compounding good disciplines or many times compounding bad disciplines. And I think that's so true. In fact, one of the things, James, that you talked about that I've underlined it, circled it, highlighted it, quoted it, replayed it. You said this, you said, winners and losers have the same goals, but they have vastly different results. And I love that. And then you started talking about systems. You said, we don't have a goal problem, but we have a system problem. The quote that stood out is this, and I'd love for you to talk about it. What do you mean by system? But you say this, you don't rise to the level of your goals, but you fall to the level of your system. Can you put some color to that for me, please?
So, you know, a lot of the time when we begin the process of change or something that we want to achieve, when we think about an outcome we want, we think about setting a goal, about achieving a particular result. But as you mentioned, I think something people often overlook is that winners and losers in any particular domain often have the same goals. You know, if you have 100 people that apply for a job, well, they all have the goal of getting the job. Or if you have, you know, a dozen athletes competing in the Olympics, they all have the goal of winning the gold medal. So goals, you know, this is not to say goals are useless. Like, they might be necessary, but not sufficient, right? Like, goals are good for setting a sense of direction, for determining, you know, clarity and where you're going to direct your effort. But once you've done that, which happens fairly early on in most processes, I think it's more useful to focus on the system rather than the goal. And so what do I mean by that? Well, your system is the collection of habits and processes, the collection of behaviors that prepare you and help you execute on whatever that goal is. And, you know, sports offers a good example or metaphor here. You know, if you're an athlete or a sports team, your goal is to win the championship or to have the best score on the scoreboard at the end of the game. But if you spent the whole game looking at the scoreboard, thinking only about the goal, you would perform terribly, right? Like, and conversely, if you didn't look at the scoreboard at all and focused only on the process, on the system of running better plays, being in the right position, preparing for the next play well, then you probably would have the best score on the scoreboard at the end of the game. And so this is kind of the surprising thing is that we set goals because we want better outcomes, but ironically, the way to actually get better outcomes is often by not thinking about the result, by ignoring the goal and pouring all of your energy and effort into building a better system.
See, I think that's brilliant and really counterintuitive for a lot of people because we do tend to think, especially, you know, we're talking to leaders, business leaders, ministry leaders, people leading their family, and we often think, I need to set some goal out in the future and try to achieve it. And then we don't really, we often don't focus on what goes into the process to help create the goal. And it sounds like you're saying if we have input goals, if we're doing the right things that lead to the wins, then the wins are going to take care of themselves. And I think as leaders, if we can create those right habits, then success tends to follow. If we're just pursuing success, we may not necessarily know how to get there. And so I want you to unpack a little bit more in that line of thinking, because we all want to change bad habits. We all want to adopt good habits. But you seem to believe that a lot of people are trying to change the wrong thing or they're trying to do it in the wrong way. What is it that we often get wrong?
Well, so I just want to say two things here. So first, before I answer this particular question, just follow up a little bit on what you hinted at there. You know, the outcomes that you want, whether it's in business or personal life, are often a lagging measure of the behaviors that preceded them. So, you know, we think about losing weight, or we think about earning more money or hitting a quarterly revenue goal, or we think about, you know, writing a book. But those things are often the lagging measure of the habits, right? Like, your weight is a lagging measure of your eating and nutrition habits. Your bank account is a lagging measure of your financial habits. Your manuscript length is a lagging measure of your writing habits, and so on for many different areas of life. And so I think that's kind of, that helps encapsulate a little bit the relationship that I think of between systems and habits and outcomes and goals, is that if you focus on the habits, then the outcomes sort of follow naturally. Now, your second point about focusing on the wrong thing, this I think is a natural consequence of the fact that we often focus on the goal rather than the system. So when most people set out to change something, they build what I would call an outcome-based habit. So they might say something like, all right, I want to lose weight. So my goal is to lose 40 pounds in the next 6 months. And in order to do that, I need to come up with a plan. So then they say, well, I'm going to follow this diet program and I'm going to work out 4 days a week. And usually the conversation stops there and they think, well, you know, once I've followed this plan and lost this weight, then I'll be the person that I want to be. Then I'll have the identity that I want to have. And my argument is that I think it's more fruitful, more productive, often just more useful to invert that process. So rather than focusing on the outcome, let's focus on the identity and let the outcome follow naturally from there. So rather than saying, all right, I want to lose 40 pounds in 6 months, let's ask ourselves the question, well, who is the type of person that could lose 40 pounds? Well, maybe it's the type of person who doesn't miss workouts. And as soon as you have that question or have that line of thinking, it changes the way that you approach it. You know, if you just say, I want to lose 40 pounds as fast as possible, well, then you do all kinds of things. You know, it's like, well, maybe I'll do a radical juice cleanse, or maybe I join a CrossFit gym or do P90X or something like that. And you get injured or you get sick or you burn out. But if you invert it and focus on the identity rather than the outcome, then you say, well, how can I be the type of person who doesn't miss workouts? Well, maybe I just do 5 pushups a day, right? Or maybe I show up at the gym for 5 minutes. And no, those things aren't going to radically transform your body overnight, but it does reinforce the identity of being the type of person who works out every day. It helps cast a vote for that new identity. And I think that in the beginning, that's the biggest hurdle to cross. It's not getting the scale to move. It's looking at yourself in a new way. It's starting to believe, this is part of my identity. This is who I am. I just write one sentence every day, or I'm the type of person who puts on their running shoes after work each day, or I'm the type of person who meditates for 1 minute. Those are not ambitious, amazing habits, but they are reinforcing and casting a vote for being a new type of person, for having that identity. And once you're there, then I think you're in a good position to expand and upgrade and continue the process of change.
You know, that was one of the things that you wrote about in the book Atomic Habits that really did stand out to me, is how your habits shape your identities. And then over time, it really changes how you see yourself and the habits tend to become more natural. Like I read about you, are you a CrossFitter? I'm trying to remember what kind of like crazy high extreme fitness you do.
Yeah, I've done a couple different things. I do tend to train at CrossFit gyms now. I was a baseball player for a long time. And then after I got done, I did a couple Olympic weightlifting competitions and powerlifting stuff. And now I just focus on strength training for fun.
Yeah, I knew you were a power lifter or strength training or hurt people or something for fun. So in that line, so somewhere along the way, you'd done some small things that helped shape your identity, that now you are a person that cares about fitness. You're an athlete, you're whatever. And I think that's one of the things that can be so helpful to people, is doing small things that reinforce their identity. That, for example, they may say, I'm an undisciplined person. Well, so simply not hitting the snooze button in the morning when the alarm goes off might set them on a track that says, oh, I was disciplined in that one choice. And then making their bed is another small habit that says, okay, therefore I'm disciplined. And I do a quiet time or a journal or whatever in the morning, or I meditate. And you know, 3 or 4 little things before they start their day that are really small compound upon each other and start changing the way they see themselves. And at the end of the day, they could have incredible production and effectiveness because of a few small things that start to change their identity.
Yeah, this is a really important point, I think. So I want to elaborate on this a little bit more. So, you know, a lot of the time when people talk about changing, they talk about things like phrases like fake it till you make it. But what I'm talking about is a little bit different than that, because fake it till you make it is asking you to believe something about yourself that you don't yet have evidence for, right? Like, oh, just, you know, think of yourself as a fit person, or think of yourself as a meditator, or believe that you can do it. And I don't think that there's anything necessarily wrong with, you know, thinking positively about yourself. It's not like it's going to hurt anything, but we have a word for beliefs that don't have evidence. We call it delusion, right? Like at some point, your brain doesn't like this conflict. I keep saying I'm a healthy person, but I'm not actually working out, and it doesn't stick. And so I think that if you want habits to stick in the long run, it's more useful to approach it from the other direction, to let the behavior lead to the belief. And this is sort of what you're referencing here. You know, like you use small habits as a way to prove to yourself that you are that kind of person, right? Like, in a sense, your habits are kind of how you embody a particular identity. You know, like every time that you go to church, you embody the identity of someone who is religious. Every time that you make your bed, you embody the identity of someone who is clean and organized. Each time that you sit down and write one sentence, you embody the identity of someone who is a writer. And eventually, if you cast enough small votes for that person, if you reinforce that identity in small ways, then you start to actually think that about yourself, because you can look back on this body of evidence that you have and say, yeah, that's who I am. And this is why I like to say that, you know, every action you take is like a vote for the kind of person that you think that you are, the kind of person that you wish to become. And so if you just keep casting votes, even if they're in very small ways, then you start to look at yourself in a new way. And I think ultimately, true behavior change is really identity change. It's really internalizing that belief that, no, this is who I am. And once you get to that point, you're not even really pursuing behavior change anymore. You don't even really have to like motivate yourself to do the right thing. You know, this is why you'll hear people say like, yeah, I don't motivate myself to go to the gym. It's just what I do. You know, it's just part of who I am. Or I don't have to push myself to meditate. It's just part of my identity now. And once you see yourself as that kind of person, then it just requires less willpower and discipline and motivation to do those things. And so that's why I think that those small votes are so meaningful, even though they seem tiny at the time.
You know, I love the language you put around that. It really spoke to me, the small votes. And so what I liked about it is you said you don't need unanimous votes to win, but you just need a majority. And so let's say you are trying to become more disciplined, or you're trying to become healthy, or whatever, and you do a few things that are right, and then you mess up in one or two places. Well, if you have a majority of the small habits moving in the right direction, suddenly over time, the majority of the votes are starting to change your identity, and you're saying, yeah, I'm not perfect, but I am a disciplined person. I am a hard worker. I am conscientious. I do care about people, whatever it is. And that language, and what I love about the book is it's what I call bottom shelf, meaning it's accessible to anyone, and you make it practical and easy to do. You don't have to be perfect, but a majority of votes moving in the right direction, and you are winning and becoming something new. I want to give you a chance to help share some of that bottom shelf advice that's so helpful. You talk about sometimes success is less about making good habits easy, and sometimes it's also about making bad habits hard. Let's start with good habits, how do you create them? And then let's dive into bad habits. How do you actually break them?
Yeah, sure. So if we're going to focus on good habits, I think there are a couple strategies that you can keep in mind that sort of help make this process easier. So in the book, I lay out what I call the four laws of behavior change. And so for building a good habit, it's make it obvious, make it obvious, make it attractive, make it easy, and make it satisfying. And those four are just kind of shorthand for a lot of the strategic and tactical examples that I give in the book for how to do those things. So I'm just going to focus on one or two right now. Obviously, there are a lot more in the book. But if I have to recommend people to start in one place, I would say start with make it easy. Start with making it as easy as possible. And I like to recommend the two-minute rule. So the two-minute rule basically says take whatever habit you're trying to build and scale it down to something that takes 2 minutes or less to do. So, you know, read 30 books a year becomes read one page, or write your book finally becomes write one sentence, or, you know, do yoga 4 days a week becomes take out my yoga mat. And sometimes people kind of resist these things, you know, because they're like, well, what I actually want to do is like run 3 miles. I don't want to just put on my running shoes, right? Which is what would take 2 minutes. And I get what they're saying, right? They think like, oh, it sounds kind of like a mental trick. And if you feel that way, then my encouragement would be to force yourself to limit yourself to just the first 2 minutes. So I had a reader who, he ended up losing over 100 pounds. And one of the first things they did was he went to the gym, but he wasn't allowed to stay for longer than 5 minutes. So he got in the car, drove to the gym, got out, did half an exercise, got back in the car and drove home. And it sounds silly, right? It sounds ridiculous. It's like, well, clearly that's not going to get you in shape. But what you realize is that he was becoming the type of person that went to the gym 4 days a week, right? He was mastering the art of showing up. And I think this is why making your habits easy and simple and small is such a crucial insight, which is that a habit must be established before it can be improved, right? You have to make it like the standard in your life, make it your new normal before you worry about optimizing or expanding or updating from there. And so often we just, you know, because of ambition or because we get motivated or because we're excited about making a change, we just tend to go all or nothing. You know, it's like, well, let me try to find the best workout program or the perfect business idea or the ideal diet to follow. And we think if we can't do it perfectly, then we might as well not do it at all. And so I feel like the 2-minute rule kind of helps counteract that tendency and get you into the pattern of showing up, even if it's in a small way, even if it's only for 2 minutes. But you got to be that kind of person who shows up for 2 minutes before you have the chance to be the person who does it in a bigger or more ambitious way.
I think that's brilliant. You got to be able to do 2 push-ups before you can do 20. And if you do 2 every day, you might wake up and do 3, and one day you're doing 20 or 40 or 50. In fact, the whole idea, make it obvious, easy, attractive, and satisfying, that I have a newer habit in my life that I tried, James, for probably, I bet you I had 5 or 6 failed attempts at journaling. I read so many people that say it's important and it's helpful, and I know that it is, but I tried to write 3 or 4 or 5 pages every day, and it would go 2 or 3 days and I'd quit. I came across a 5-year journal, which it really embodies everything that you say. You only have to write 4 or 5 lines and you're done. And then you can see kind of year over year. If I look back to the previous year on the same exact day, I can see what I did in 2 years, 3 years and such. So I'm now starting into my 5th year on this, and I put the journal out by my bed. So it's obvious. It takes me less than probably 3 minutes to do. It's easy. The journal looks good. It's attractive. And I'm a journaler now. It's satisfying. And so it's changed my identity. And every single one of those steps you said is the difference between failure and actually becoming a journaler. Now it's not just something I do. It's part of my identity. It's who I am. And so I think your ideas are fantastic. I love the two-minute start. Stopping, though, is a whole different strategy. What would you say to, now I've got something, I want to quit smoking, I want to quit sleeping in too late, I want to quit yelling at people. What suggestions do you have for stopping?
Let's use the sleeping example. And so first of all, if you want to break a bad habit, then my high level recommendation is just invert those 4 laws. So make it obvious, make it attractive, make it easy, make it satisfying. That's for building a good habit. Then if you want to break a bad one, you want to make it invisible. So make the cues of your bad habits less visible, make it unattractive, make it difficult. So increase the friction, make it less convenient, and make it unsatisfying. So have like a punishment instead of a reward. So, you know, a lot of the time people procrastinate or fall into this bad habit or whatever for a couple different reasons, but I'll give you kind of 2 ideas for kind of curtailing these behaviors or breaking them. So, first one, you might be surprised how many bad habits will fade away or reduce themselves just if they're not as obvious or convenient as they were before, you know? So like, take the habit of watching television. A lot of people feel like they watch too much TV, but if you walk into pretty much any living room in America, where do all the couches and chairs face? You know, like they all face the television. So it's like, what is that room designed to get you to do? It's the most obvious and available and frictionless habit in that space. So there are a variety of steps you can take here, right? It's kind of on a spectrum from like least extreme to most extreme, but you could take the chair and turn it away from the TV so that it faces a coffee table with a book on it. You could put the remote control inside of a shelf or a drawer so that you're, you know, less likely to see it. You could take the television itself and put it in a wall unit or a cabinet so that it's behind doors. And then you could also, you know, increase the friction of the task. So you could like unplug the TV after each use and then only plug it back in if you can say the name of the show that you want to watch. So you can't, you know, just turn Netflix on and find something. Or, you know, if you want to be really extreme, you could take the TV off the wall, put it in the closet, and then only set it back up if you really wanted to watch something. I actually had one reader who, she and her husband, they watched a ton of sports events, and eventually they were like, this is so ridiculous, we need to figure out a way to reduce the amount of time we're spending watching stuff. And so they decided they just were going to get rid of their TV. And their new measure was, if we don't care enough about this game to drive down the street and drive 15 minutes and watch it at the sports bar, then we don't actually want to watch it. And, you know, again, variety of things there, from most extreme to, or least extreme to most extreme. But just implementing some of those things will reduce the odds that you fall into that habit. I've seen this in other areas too, you know, like, for example, take beer. If I have a beer in my fridge and it's in the front of the fridge, it's like somewhere I can see it on the shelf that's like right in front of the door, or it's in the door, then I'll grab one and drink it at night just because it's there. But if I take that same six pack and I slide it like on the lowest shelf all the way to the back where I can't really see it when I open the door, sometimes it'll sit there for like a month. And so it's like, well, did I want it or not? You know, like I kind of wanted it if it was there, but if you just make it less obvious, then you're less likely to fall into it. Now, I do want to kind of add an addendum there, which is to say that, and this I think is true for all the ideas in Atomic Habits, I'm not going to say that this is going to stop like a true addiction, right? If you're actually dealing with alcoholism or something like that, it's different. But I do think that all these strategies are useful, whether you're an addict or not, that, you know, they do kind of help nudge you in the right direction. So that's the first piece, make it invisible. But the second idea, let's come back to that sleeping example that you gave. So you want to stop sleeping in, or, you know, maybe you want to get up early and do a workout instead before work or something like that. Well, one thing that you can do is that you can make it less attractive. You can make it unattractive to stay in bed. So how do you do that? Well, one strategy is to use what psychologists call a commitment device. So let's say that you go to bed, you're like, all right, I'll set my alarm. Tomorrow's going to be the day. I'll wake up at 6 and I'll go for a run. Go to sleep and 6 a.m. rolls around and, you know, your bed is warm, it's cold outside, and you're like, well, you know, I kind of feel like sleeping, and you press snooze and you don't do the run. But if you rewind the clock, go back to the previous day, and this time you text a friend and you say, hey, can we meet at the park at 6:30 and go for a run? Well, now 6 a.m. rolls around and your bed is still warm and still cold outside. But if you don't get out and go for the run, well, now you're a jerk because you leave your friend at the park all alone. And so that text that you sent, that's like a commitment device. It's a way to lock in your future behavior. You kind of change the equation in your mind so that now sleeping in means something different. It doesn't just mean you get to stay in a warm bed. It also means, oh, you're being a bad friend. And so little devices like that, little strategies like that, and I have a longer list of them in the book, they help you get over some of those bad habits or reframe the equation in your mind so that they're not as attractive as they were in the past.
Yeah, so you can make something more difficult if you continue to hit the snooze button, take your phone or your alarm clock, put it in the other room, and it goes off, it makes you get out of bed. I think that your suggestions are so good. I was thinking about if you go back and like look at pictures of me 8 years ago, you'll probably notice a difference because my diet was really, really different. And I had the hardest time just saying no to pretty much any kind of junk food. And mostly my wife, she just changed what I had access to, meaning I don't go to the grocery store often. And so the food she'd order and such, it's healthy everywhere. I started ordering food delivered to my office every day. And so I don't have access to something that's not as healthy. And because of that, it changed what I crave. Now I don't desire the other stuff. And it's simply by making it invisible. I don't see it. Making it unattractive. Now I don't really want it. It tastes as good. Making it difficult. And when you, after you do that for a while, you start to see your body change and it changes your identity. Like, hey, this really feels a lot better. You alluded, James, too, to the, you know, your friend. I think that kind of introduces a big idea. If you tell your friend you're going to join them to run, that's accountability. How important would you say accountability is in the success of good and bad habits?
Yeah, that's a great question. So this is something, you know, I wrote about the influence of the social environment on your habits in the book. I think it's chapter 9 or chapter 10. And your family and friends play a really crucial role in what habits you find attractive and what things you feel motivated to do. You know, like there are a lot of examples of this, you know, like if you move into a new neighborhood and you walk outside on Tuesday night and you see all of your neighbors have their recycling out, then you think, oh, you know, I guess recycling is something that people do in this neighborhood. Like people like us need to sign up for that. So then you get in the habit of doing that every week. Or, you know, all your family members are going to church on Sunday. So then you're like, well, you know, we need to go too. And even if you don't consciously think those things, you start to internalize that, right? We kind of get like nudged along or pulled along by the people that surround us or what our family and friends are doing. And this can be a powerful way to build, you know, pretty much any kind of habit. But I think that I undersold the importance of how socially reinforced our behavior is. I mean, man, there are so many things, you know, like, why do you stop at red lights and stop signs? You do it because that's the expectation, right? That's what everybody else in the society does. And there are so many habits that are like that. Things where we fall in line because we know the expectation is to act that way. You know, why do you wear a dress or a suit and tie to a job interview? There's no reason you have to do that. You could wear a bathing suit if you wanted, but you don't because that's not what the tribe or that group or society at large expects for that situation. And so many choices and behaviors throughout life are shaped that way. So your question was, I think, probably more about accountability specifically, right? Like having a friend expecting that of you. But I bring that up, this larger social phenomenon up, because I think that that in many ways might be the more powerful form of accountability. What does the tribe expect? What does your group, whether it's your coworkers or the people that you work out with at the gym or the people that you, you know, play chess with or volunteer with on the weekend or whatever the thing is, whatever the group is that you're a part of, what do they expect? And what the group expects is often the most powerful form of accountability. And I think it's worth it to mention why that's the case. You know, our ancestors grew up in tribes. And if you were abandoned by the tribe, then it was a death sentence. And so we all are wired to have this deep sense of belonging, this deep sense of community, to belong to the people around us. And so nobody wants to be ostracized from the group. Nobody wants to be abandoned by the tribe. And because of that, we care deeply about what others think of us, about what the expectations of the group is, whether that's at work or at home or elsewhere. And we care about it because it helps us if people think better of us, if people think highly of us. And so I don't know that there's any way to get around that. You know, a lot of the time people talk about it like it's a bad thing, you know, like, well, don't let people's opinions of you sway you, or don't worry too much about what others think. And I agree, when taken to an extreme, that's certainly not a healthy thing to do. But the truth is, caring about what those around us think and what they expect is often a really good strategy. That's the reason we stop at red lights and stop signs, and or at least one of the reasons. So my point there is that be very careful about the tribes that you join, about the groups that you spend time with. Think carefully about those people that you're surrounded by and what those social norms are for those groups. Because the social norms of the group, the expectations of the tribe, is maybe the most powerful form of accountability when it comes to sticking with habits for the long term.
I think you're dead on with that. And you know, I don't know how direct you would be with people, but I think if we're stuck in a lot of bad habits, chances are pretty good the people that we're around are stuck in the same types of habits. And if we're growing and adding the right disciplines to our lives, chances are pretty good we're around people like that. And so some people might push back and say, you're being harsh, or this is an unfair question, but would you say there are times when you really need to redefine, you know, the types of people that you're hanging out with to completely change your life?
Well, so I think there are a couple things to say here. You know, like, one is, there's a lot to unpack with stuff like this, because, you know, your relationships are some of the most valuable things in your entire life. And so it's very hard and complicated to change your family and friends or change the group of people you're hanging out with and so on. And so I don't usually say things like, oh, you need to fire your friends and find new ones or things like that, because the truth is it's very challenging. And honestly, we all have responsibilities in life too, right? So like, you, in many cases, family members, like, what are you going to do? Abandon your family? You know, like, it's just not a reasonable thing to ask for most people. So I think instead, a more productive and more practical approach is to say, look, you don't have to get rid of these people. It's not about that. It's not about abandoning the group. But it's really hard to sustain habits when you're surrounded by a tribe that has conflicting motives or different priorities, right? It's really hard to stick to a healthy diet if you're surrounded by people who eat junk all the time. It's really hard to go to the gym if you're surrounded by people who don't want to work out ever. And so I'm not saying that you need to never see those people, but what's really powerful is having a sacred space, having some kind of place where you can do those things, where you're surrounded by people who do have the same goals. So, you know, maybe nobody in your family wants to do yoga. Maybe they don't care about that. But go to the yoga studio where you can be surrounded by a dozen other people who are really excited about that habit, and have at least 1 hour for yourself where you're surrounded by a positive environment that kind of uplifts and reinforces that. And so, you know, the other 23 hours of the day you can spend with, you know, the people that you normally are around, but give yourself a chance for that habit to thrive by surrounding yourself with people who have the same goals as you. You know, you often rise together. And as you do that, you know, then you can start to gradually think about, okay, is this becoming a really important thing for me? You know, do I want to become a yoga instructor now? Or, you know, is this going to play a bigger role in my life? Maybe I need to, you know, to give it even more of my time than an hour or so on. But you can make that decision down the line. I think in the beginning, it's just important to give yourself a space where a habit can thrive, because ultimately, I don't know that I've ever seen anybody consistently stick to a positive habit in a negative environment. And so it's really just about finding kind of those points where you can give yourself a place for that habit to grow.
Yeah, I appreciate your sensitivity to the complexities of relationships and the importance of really honoring people and sticking with our priorities. But I really think a mistake that a lot of us make is we let the relationships just kind of happen to us instead of being intentional about it. And if we're in a really bad environment, it doesn't mean we necessarily divorce our friends, but we might need to redefine just how much access we give them to us, or that let them have in our lives, and really do seek out, I think, the intentional relationships that can help us eliminate the things that are dangerous and hurtful and bring in the things that are helpful. One of the things you talked about, James, that I thought was really interesting, you talked about the mismatch between immediate and delayed rewards. Good habits, you start doing something, you know, you start jogging, you start praying, you start reading, you start journaling, you start writing thank you notes to people, and you don't see an immediate result. But then you do something like eat the whole piece of cake and you get your dopamine rush, or you play video games and you get your dopamine rush, and the bad things seem to be more fun at first, and the good disciplines and habits seem to take a frustrating amount of time before you start seeing results. Can you kind of add some context to how you approach that and what it means to us?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's a complicated thing. There's sort of this like valley of death often when it comes to building a new habit. You know, like say you go to the gym, like what is the reward for working out for like 3 weeks? It's not really a whole lot, honestly. You know, like you've been staying consistent, working hard, but your body looks basically the same. Like there's not really much outcome. If anything, your muscles are probably sore and, you know, you still don't have the results that you were looking for. And that kind of thing is true for many habits, you know, like what is the reward of working on your book for an hour every day and doing that for 3 months? Like the book probably still isn't done. And so, this is the case for many good habits, which is that the immediate outcome is often kind of unfavorable, and it's only the ultimate outcome that is more enjoyable or satisfying. With bad habits, as you mentioned, it's often the reverse. So, you know, like the immediate outcome of eating a donut is kind of great. It's sugary, it's tasty, it's enjoyable. It's only the ultimate outcome if you keep doing that each day and you turn around a year later and, you know, now you've gained weight and so on. So the way that I would phrase this is that the cost of your bad habits is in the future. The cost of your good habits is in the present. And so what you're looking for are ways to change that equation, ways to make your good habits more enjoyable while you're waiting for those long-term rewards to accumulate. And there are a couple different ways you can do this. You know, like one thing you can do is one of the most enjoyable or satisfying feelings is the feeling of making progress, the feeling that, hey, I'm moving forward, I'm getting better, this is worth it. And habit tracking is one way to sort of reinforce that. So the simplest version of a habit tracker is you just put an X on the calendar each day. And like my dad, for example, he likes to go swimming. So each day that he goes to the pool and does his swimming, he comes back and he puts a little X on this little like pocket calendar he has. And then at the end of the month, pulls the calendar out and looks at it and tallies up how many times he went swimming and then compares that to the previous month. And you know, it doesn't have anything to do with the workout itself, but on the bad days, on the days when he feels like, oh, I don't really feel like going in, or I feel like that wasn't a very good workout or whatever, he can look back on that calendar and be like, yeah, you know what? Like, I didn't feel good today, but I still showed up 12 times this month or whatever the number is. So having some kind of visual cue of the progress that you're making, some way to visualize that, whether it's a calendar on the wall or the number of pages that you've read this week or whatever the thing is that you're tracking, that's a good way to add a little bit of satisfaction to the moment so that you feel like it was worth it, even if you're still waiting for those long-term rewards to accrue.
Yeah, I'd love to spend a little bit more time on that thought because I think this can this was helpful to me. If I've got a goal out in the future, it could be weeks, months, or years before I achieve that goal. And it seems like I'm deferring my happiness until a milestone out in the future. How do we stay motivated and how can we be happy long before we achieve that distant goal?
Yeah, man, this is a tough question. You know, I've wrestled with this myself for a while. Like, do you have to be dissatisfied to be driven? Do you have to be dissatisfied with your current state to be motivated enough to say, oh, I'm going to keep working on this? And the best solution that I've come up with, I'll give you two ways to answer this. So the first way is just to say, when you do some kind of measurement or tracking like that, when you record each instance of your habit, you are proving to yourself that you have a certain type of identity. And so if you choose an identity that's motivating to you, that's interesting or exciting to you, then that's a way to feel successful in the moment while you're also waiting for those long-term rewards to accumulate. You know, so like each time you sit down and write for 10 minutes, you put a little X on that habit tracker and you feel like I casted a vote for being a writer today. And that feels good because that's who I want to become. And so now you can feel happy and satisfied in the moment and you ultimately are moving toward that goal of writing the book or whatever it is. The second thing to consider though, is that you can also utilize what we were just talking about like the social component. You know, like on days when I don't feel good or I feel like I got a bad workout in or whatever, I still enjoy going to the gym because it means I get to see some of my friends. And so this is another one of the really powerful things that social accountability or just a social environment provides is that if you're hanging out with people that you really like, people who kind of embody the identity that you're looking to build, then it feels good to be with them even if you haven't accomplished the goal yet. You know, it's just nice to hang out with good people. And so that's another way to really feel satisfied in the moment while you're kind of waiting for that long-term stuff to show up.
So the book is called Atomic Habits, Tiny Changes, Remarkable Results. The author, New York Times best-selling author on his first book is James Clear. And James, one of the things that I really liked is you talked about, instead of just thinking about the do, this is what I want to do, we need to really start with the who. I know you're a pro baseball player. I know you are incredibly disciplined. You're a photographer. You're a blogger. You're an author. I'm curious, as you're bringing new habits into your life, who is the future James becoming?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I'm not going to answer it specifically, but I'm going to tell you more about my process for figuring that out. So who I'm becoming is a moving target, right? Like, context changes, life changes, you kind of go through different seasons, you know, like maybe you're in a season where you're very career focused and then you have some kids and then your season is more family focused and then your kids go to college and then you go back and do a career focused season, or maybe you're focused on your health or whatever. And so that question of what identity do I want to build? It's going to shift over time. And for that reason, I think one of the most important sort of meta habits to build, and this is how I answer this question for myself, is the process of reflection and review. So I do this in two different ways. So at the end of each year, I conduct an annual review where I ask myself three questions. What went well this year? What didn't go so well? And then what am I working toward or what did I learn? So when I ask myself those questions, it's kind of a chance to reflect on my habits. I do a lot of measurement too. So I track, you know, how many workouts did I do this year and how many new places did I travel to and how many articles did I write and stuff like that. So it's just kind of a chance to be self-aware and to figure out where I actually stand rather than, you know, thinking I'm doing better than I am. And then, I get to reflect on what I learned and so on. And that's kind of a chance for me to set the baseline. Then about 6 months later, I do what I call an integrity report each summer. And again, it's got three questions. So what are my values? What are my values and principles? What do I stand for? Second question is, how did I live by those values this last year? So kind of a chance to pat yourself on the back and, you know, think about where you did a good job. And then the most important one for me is, where did I fail to live up to those values and principles? You know, like where did I kind of feel like I fell off course? And I think this is the key piece of maintaining integrity, which, you know, there are many ways to define integrity, but I'll, for the context of this conversation, I'll say living in alignment with your desired identity, right? Living in, being the type of person that you wish to become, living in alignment with those values and principles. And so integrity is kind of a funny thing because, like, pretty much everybody thinks that they have it. It'd be very weird to talk to somebody and have them say, like, oh, I'm not a person of integrity, right? It'd just be strange to hear that. And so the question is, well, if everybody has it or thinks they have it, then how do you lose it? And I think it's a gradual slide. I think it's, you know, a series of kind of like just this once exceptions. You know, you're like, oh, well, this time it's a little bit different, so we'll do it this way. Or maybe this time, you know, I can let it slide. And so that integrity report helps kind of pull me back to center, helps keep me on track with the habits that you know, reinforce the identity that I want to build and become. So I think between those two, having the annual review at the end of each year and kind of reflecting on where my habits have been and where I've been headed, and then the integrity report to ask myself, you know, what are my values and principles now? You know, have anything changed? Has anything changed from last year? And in concert, when I have those together, I have a good process for reflecting on where I'm at and where I want to head. And I think that that is an important way to answer that question of who are you becoming, of, you know, who are you looking to develop into? Because ultimately, it's a continuous process. It's not a, oh, I just decide the kind of person I want to be and I can let it ride for 40 years. It's something you need to continue to revisit, I think, each year. And who knows, maybe even more consistently than I do it. But I think that having some kind of process of reflection and review is a good way to keep yourself on track and answer that question over time.
You know, I love that. I know a lot of people that review different measurements of success, but to look at, you know, did I live according to my values? That's so important, because if we don't get that part right, then all the external success really falls way, way short. So I just want to express my gratitude to you, James. Thank you for coming on the podcast. And more so, your book, it kind of feels like a lifelong effort. I think you've been studying this for a long time, and it really, really shows. So thank you for your investment in the work you put into the book. It's called Atomic Habits. I hope that if everyone listening to it has not read or listened to this book, I highly, highly recommend it. And just as a side note, I listen to and read a lot of books, a lot of books. And I put this at the top of the list in the last several years of books that I'm recommending. So it really, really is a good one. If someone wants to find out more about you or kind of continue learning from you, what's the best way for them to do that, James?
Yeah, well, thank you so much. I'm so glad you enjoyed it. So thank you for the kind words and review. You can find more of my work at jamesclear.com. So if you just click on articles, I have them organized by category, so you can kind of poke around and see what's interesting to you. If you'd like to check out the book directly, it's called Atomic Habits, An Easy and Proven Way to Build Good Habits and Break Bad Ones. And you can get that at atomichabits.com.
James, thanks so much. Appreciate having you on.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us at the Craig Rochelle Leadership Podcast. If you want to go even deeper into this episode and get the leadership guide or show notes, you can go to life.church/leadership podcast. You can also sign up to have that information delivered straight to your inbox every month. In the meantime, you can subscribe to this podcast, rate and review it on iTunes, and share with your friends on social media. Once again, thank you for joining us at the Craig Rochelle Leadership Podcast.